And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today it is a rainy, snowy day in El Paso. I was out earlier and the snow was so heavy that you couldn't see 15 feet in front of your face. And this is West Texas. March 14th, Monday, is National Pie Day. So you go to your, where you get your local pie and tell them they ought to sell it to you at 3.14 per slice. I've been harassing the company that I get my pie from. In theory, they agree with me. In practice, Well, today's March 11th, 70th day of the year. 295 days remain till the year's over with. In 222, Alexander Severus becomes Emperor of Rome, replacing his cousin, 18-year-old Elagabalus. The bodies of the assassinated emperor and his mother, Julia Salamis, were dragged through the streets of the city and thrown into the Tiber. 1343, Arnost of Pardubice becomes the last bishop of Prague, and a year later, the first archbishop of Prague. They get a better-looking hat when they become archbishop. 1641, Guarani forces living in the Jesuit reductions defeat Bandeirantes loyal to the Portuguese Empire at the Battle of Mabarore. In 1649, the Frondeurs and the French signed the Peace of Riel. 1702, the Daily Courant, England's most first national daily newspaper, is published for the first time. 1708, Queen Anne withholds royal assent from the Scottish Militia Bill, the last time a British monarch vetoes the legislation. 1784, the signing of the Treaty of Mangalore brings the Second Anglo-Mysore War to an end. 1795, the Battle of Karda is fought between Maratha Confederacy and the Nizam of Hyderabad, resulting in Maratha victory. 1845, the Flagstaff War. Unhappy with translational differences regarding the Treaty of Waitangi, chiefs Honihiki, Kawiti, and Maori tribe members chopped down the British flagpole for a fourth time and drive the settlers out of Kororo Rica, New Zealand. 1848, Louis Hippolyte Lafontaine and Robert Baldwin become the first prime ministers of the province of Canada to be democratically elected under a system of responsible government. Would that we had such a thing today. The 1851, the first performance of Rigoletto by Giuseppe Verdi takes place in Venice. 1861, American Civil War. Constitution of Confederate States of America is adopted on this date. 1864, the Great Sheffield Flood kills 238 people in Sheffield, England. 1872, construction of the Seven Sisters Colliery in South Wales begins, located on one of the richest coal sources in Britain. 1879, Shaotai formally abdicates his position as King of Ryukyu under orders from Tokyo, ending the Ryukyu Kingdom. 1888, the Great Blizzard of 1888 begins along the eastern seaboard of the U.S., shutting down commerce and killing more than 400 people. 1917, World War I, Mesopotamian Campaign. Baghdad falls to Anglo-Indian forces commanded by General Frederick Stanley Maude. 1927, in New York City, Samuel Waxy Rothafel opens a Roxy Theater. 1941, World War II, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt signs the Lend-Lease Act into law, allowing American-built war supplies to be shipped to the Allies on loan. 1945, World War II, Imperial Japanese Navy attempts a large-scale kamikaze attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet anchored at Ulithi Atoll in Operation 10, number 2. 1945, World War II, the Empire of Vietnam, a short-lived Japanese puppet state established. 1946, Rudolf Hulse, the first commandant of Auschwitz concentration camp, is captured by British troops. 1977 and 1977, Hanafi siege. About 150 hostages held in Washington, D.C. by Hanafi Muslims are set free after ambassadors from three Islamic nations join negotiations. 1978, the Coastal Road Massacre. At least 37 are killed, more than 70 are wounded when Fatah hijacked an Israeli bus, prompting Israel's Operation Latani. 1981, hundreds of students protest in the University of Pristina in Kosovo, which was then part of Yugoslavia, to give their province more political rights. The protest went on to become a nationwide movement. 1983, Bob Hawke is appointed Prime Minister of Australia. 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev is elected to the position of General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, making Gorbachev the USSR's de facto and last head of state. He oversaw the dissolution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. 1990, Lithuania declares independence from the Soviet Union. Also in 1990, Patricio Aylwin is sworn in as the first democratically elected president of Chile since 1970. 2004, Madrid train bombing. Simultaneous explosions on rush hour trains in Madrid, Spain, kill 191 people. 2006, is inaugurated as the first female president of Chile. 2009, Winnenden school shooting, 16 are killed, 11 are injured before recent graduate Tim Kretschmer shoots and kills himself, leading to tightened weapons restrictions in Germany. 2010, economist and businessman Sebastian Piñera is sworn in as the president of Chile. Aftershocks of the 2010 Pichidli Mu earthquake hit central Chile during the ceremony. 2011, an earthquake measuring 9.0 in magnitude strikes 81 miles east of Sendai, Japan, triggering a tsunami killing thousands of people. This event also triggered the second largest nuclear accident in history and one of only two events to be classified as a level 7 on the International Nuclear Event Scale. 2012, a U.S. soldier killed 16 civilians in the Panjwayi district of Afghanistan near Kandahar. 2020, the World Health Organization declares COVID-19 virus a pandemic. It became official, folks. 2021, U.S. President Joe, man, I am just so wonderful. Biden signs the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan into law. I'm not sure who it rescued. Probably his friends. A lot of births and deaths on his state in history. Holidays observances, Christian Feast Day, Alberta of Agen, Constantine, Owingus of Talat, Sophronius of Jerusalem, Vindicianus, Day of Restoration of Independence from the Soviet Union in 1990 in Lithuania, Moshushu Day in Lesotho. Let's see what else we got. In 843, the icon veneration officially reinstated in Hagia Sophia Cathedral in Constantinople. 1502, Ismail I, founder of the Safavid dynasty, crowned Shah of Persia, rules till 1524. 1918, Moscow becomes the capital of revolutionary Russia. 1966, a military coup led by Indonesian General Suharto breaks out. In 85, Mikhail Gorbachev replaces Konstantin Chernenko, a Soviet leader. In 2018, China's National People's Congress approves the removal of term limits for a leader, which allow Xi Jinping presidency for life. In 1425, Thutmose III, Pharaoh of Egypt, dies. 537, the Gosley sieves to Rome. 928, Tripomir II succeeds to the Croatian throne. 1387, the Battle of Castagnaro begins. 1513, Giovanni de' Medici, chosen Pope Leo X. 1597, Archduke Albrecht occupies Amiens in France. 1665, New York approves a new code guaranteeing Protestants religious rights. 1669, Mount Etna in Sicily erupts in its largest recorded eruption. 15,000 people die. 1744, an English auction house known as Sotheby's holds its first ever auction. It auctioned books. It was in London. 1779, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is established. 1789, Benjamin Banneker and Pierre Charles L'Enfant begin to lay out Washington, D.C. Now, Banneker was a mathematician, an astronomer, and an almanac author. Now, credentials were for laying out a city is anybody's guess, but L'Enfant was an architect. 1791, Samuel Millikan is the first to obtain more than one U.S. patent. 1795, the battle at Khurdia in India. Marathan beats the Mughals. 1812, citizenship is granted to Prussian Jews. 1823, the first normal school in the U.S. opens, Concord Academy in Concord, Vermont. 1824, the U.S. War Department creates the Bureau of Indian Affairs. 1850, the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania opens up, the second female medical school in the U.S. U.S. has banned Russian seafood and vodka. That's just a news item that's come out. That's really going to hit the Russians where they live. And while President Biden is, last I heard, was on vacation, afraid somebody's going to yell boo at him. Okay, on this date in 1855, the Bowery Boys gang leader, William Poole, also known as Bill the Butcher, is buried in Brooklyn. There were 155 carriages that showed up and 6,000 mourners. 1861, the Confederate Convention in Montgomery, Alabama, adopts the Confederate Constitution. 1862, on this date, Abraham Lincoln removes General George McClellan as General-in-Chief. He was a phenomenal trainer, but not worth crap as a tactician. 1862, General Stonewall Jackson evacuates Winchester, Virginia. Army of the Potomac, General Henry Halleck is named General-in-Chief. He wasn't great shakes either. 1864, the Dale Dyke on the Humber River crumbles, killing at least 240 in Sheffield in Yorkshire, England. 1865, General Sherman's Union forces occupy Fayetteville, North Carolina. 1869, the West first learns about the giant panda from a French missionary named Armand David, who gets a skin from a hunter. 1882, Fridtjof Nansen sets out on a sea voyage to study Arctic zoology. In 1895, the Spanish cruiser Reina Regente sinks in the Straits of Gibraltar. 400 die. 1897, a meteorite enters the Earth's atmosphere and explodes over New Martinsville, West Virginia. The debris does cause a lot of damage, but there are no human injuries reported. 1901, Cincinnati Inquirer reports Baltimore manager John McGraw signed a Cherokee Indian named Tokahoma. Tokahoma's really a black second baseman named Charlie Grant. I guess that just goes to show it's not what you say, it's how you say it. 1915, the British declare a blockade of all German ports. 1917, the British occupy Baghdad, the capital of Mesopotamia, after the Turkish forces evacuate. 1918, the Save the Redwoods League is founded. Also in 1918, U.S. Army mess cook Private Albert Gitchell of Fort Riley, Kansas, becomes the first documented case of Spanish flu. That was the start of a worldwide pandemic that killed 50 to 100 million. 1919, a general strike in Germany is crushed. In 1920, Syria proclaims Emir Faisal king after the country's fought off French domination. 1927, the first armored commercial car holdup in the U.S. took place in Pittsburgh. 1930, William Taft, the 27th President and Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, is buried in the Arlington Cemetery. 1935, Hermann Göring officially creates the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. 1938, Arthur Sesenquart replaces Kurt von Schuschnigg as Chancellor of Austria. German troops also enter that country on this date. This day in 1941, Bronco Nagurski beat Ray Steele in Minnesota to become the wrestling champion. 1942, the first deportation train leaves Paris for Auschwitz concentration camp. 1942, General MacArthur leaves with Corregidor, Bataan, if you will, for Australia. He heard of those immortal words, "We shall return," if you're not shooting at me. 1942, Japanese troops land on North Sumatra. 1943, Nazi militia forms in the Netherlands. 1944, Dutch resistance fighter Joop Westerweel is arrested. 1945, 1,000 Allied bombers harass Essen. 4,662 tons of bombs are dropped. 1945, Flemish Nazi collaborator Maria Huggins sentenced to death. 1948, the Jewish Agency of Jerusalem is bombed. 1953, the first woman army doctor is commissioned. 1954, the army charges Senator McCarthy with using undue pressure tactics. 1958, an American B-47 accidentally drops a nuclear bomb 15,000 feet
owned a family house in Mars Bluff, South Carolina, created a crater 75 feet across. Luckily for all concerned, the bomb did not have its nuclear capsule. 1958, Charles Van Doren finally loses on U.S. TV game show 21 after winning $129,000. Investigation later showed the game was fixed. 1960, Pioneer 5 is launched into solar orbit between the Earth and Venus. 1963, Somalia drops diplomatic relations with Great Britain. 1963, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara ordered the adoption by the U.S. military of the M16 assault rifle. Now, the M16 was originally designed as the AR-15 by Eugene Stoner, who was a well-known inventor of various weapons. I knew McNamara's daughter-in-law. Crazy as a road lizard. 1965, Indonesia President Sukarno signs the Super Samar Order, giving Army Commander Lieutenant General Suharto authority to do whatever he deemed necessary to restore order in the country. 1966, military coup led by Indonesian General Suharto breaks out. Sukarno was the first president. Suharto became the second president. 1966, a fire at two ski resorts in Numata, Japan kills 31 people. 1970, the Iraqi Ba'ath Party recognizes the Kurd nation. 1970, let's see if there's anything else. In 1974, the Rhino store gives people 5 cents to take home a Danny Bonaduce album. 1975, a rightist military coup in Portugal under General Antonio de Spinola fails. And in 1978, terrorists attack a mail truck in Tel Aviv. 45 people are killed. 1975, I think that pretty much wraps up our little history segment. There are quite a number of unsolved murders in this country in general, but in Hollywood especially. And we've been talking about a number of them. Yesterday we talked about Woods. Natalie Woods, who supposedly fell off the boat and drowned. Now, on that boat was her husband, Robert Wagner, and Christopher Walken. And Christopher Walken has been very tight-lipped about the whole ordeal. He hadn't said much. And he's been so quiet that many who are not aware of the story are shocked to learn that this superstar was even present on the night that Woods died. Supposedly, she and Wagner got into a real Donnybrook over the fact she was flirting with Walken. Aiding in the perception of Walken's innocence, though, is the fact that both Captain Davern and Robert Wagner insisted Walken was asleep when Woods went missing. So unless it was some sort of elaborate, bizarre conspiracy between all three men, it would seem Walken most likely really did sleep through the whole thing. And his silence is actually more of a pragmatic caution than anything nefarious. Of the three men, it's always been Robert Wagner who was the most likely suspect in a potential case of foul play. And the suspicion swirling around Wagner just would not go away. 2018, the case, which had already been reopened, designated Walker as a person of interest. And as general interest in this case has grown, a rather stunning documentary about the whole episode came out in 2020. It was called Natalie Woods, What Remains Behind. And as a result, new questions are being asked, and Robert Wagner, who's now in his 90s, has found himself having to fight to prove his innocence once again. Well, there's not been any trial or conviction in this case, and nobody's really 110% sure exactly how she died. So that, of course, is something that needs to be established before you determine who did it, if anyone did do it. Now we have the next case is the death of Marvin Gaye. He died in Los Angeles, April 1st, 1984. And you'd be surprised at the person who was convicted of his death. Now, Marvin Gaye's last name was the original G-A-Y. He added the E at the end of his name soon after he became famous. Son of a preacher, Marvin Gaye Sr. and his wife, Alberta Gaye. Now, Marvin grew up in the poorer neighborhoods of Washington, D.C., developed a love of singing as a young age, and often performed at his parents' Pentecostal church. Now, his parents were often threadbare, and the hardship of an era of his life wasn't in a, certainly didn't give lead to an easy upbringing. And to make matters worse, his father was borderline abusive with harsh treatment of Marvin. Gaye later recalled how he'd get beat by his dad for the slightest perceived offense. During these tough times, it was always music that Marvin Gaye would fall back on as his greatest source of comfort. Now, as a young man, he continued to sing, and by high school had participated in several singing groups. Now, while he excelled at singing, his grades weren't the best, and he ended up dropping out in 1956. 17, he joined the military. Unfortunately, he didn't enjoy military life and regretted the fact he had even enlisted and feigned mental illness just to get discharged. Ended up getting what's known as a general discharge, neither good nor bad. Upon his arrival back in civilian life, he joined up with a local group called the Marquees. The vocals band began to tour all the greater D.C. area, and after gaining some traction, managed to get signed in OK Records. After recording the single Wide Earp, though, the group had a little success and subsequently taken off the OK Records roster. Shortly after this, Marvin joined up with singer Harvey Fuqua to form the group Harvey Fuqua and New Moon Glows. Now, this group broke up in the 60s, in 1960 actually, and Gaye and Fuqua both headed over to Detroit, Michigan. It was in Detroit that Marvin Gaye caught the attention of Motown's Berry Gordy, and this led to Marvin singing with a Motown affiliate called Tamla. And it was with Tamla he would release the album, The Soulful Moods of Marvin Gaye. Now, the album unfortunately proved to be a failure, and Gaye was forced to resort to working as a radio session backup singer in order to make any money. In between session work, though, he did find time to record his own songs, and in 1963 he managed to craft his first hit. It's called Pride and Joy. The next year, 1964, he then released a live album that contained another breakout hit. The song was Can I Get a Witness, and it was the first of many more hits to come throughout the 60s. Now, most of these hits were romantic feel-good tunes, but it was in 1971 his most introspective piece, What's Going On, to be released and end up becoming his most well-known song. And the subsequent What's Going On album also became a bestseller. Well, in 1973, he released an album, Let's Get It On, became a fan favorite with the title track reaching number one on the charts. And even though he had reached the top, it was seemingly all downhill from there. His next major album, Here My Dear, was a commercial flop. Disappointed with the failure of his new music, he began to descend into drug use, and these were disappointing times for Marvin Gaye for sure, but he wasn't about to give up. In 1982, he mounted a major comeback. His album Midnight Love managed to bring him another number one hit. It's called Sexual Healing. It turns out to be one of the most popular R&B tracks for the decade, and he was awarded a Grammy for his efforts. Now, he was riding high on his newfound success, but it would all come to a sudden abrupt halt April 1st, 1984, when he was said to have been shot and killed by his own father. Well, it was the 1st of April. Marvin Gaye was at his parents' house and got in an argument with them, with his father, and the argument got out of hand. Argument apparently began between Marvin Sr. and his wife Alberta, and the couple was arguing over an insurance policy when Marvin Gaye overheard. Marvin confronted his father, and the verbal conflict escalated into a physical conflict. Alberta later testified she saw her son Marvin punching and kicking Marvin Sr. And while she was certainly sad at the end result of her son being killed, she acknowledged that Marvin Gaye was probably a little bit out of control at that point. She later testified Marvin hit him and I shouted for him to stop, but he didn't pay me any attention. And he gave my husband some hard kicks. It was after this physical altercation ran its course that the badly beaten Marvin Sr. made the fateful decision to pull out a gun and shoot his own son. Well, the superstar singer Marvin Gaye was shot twice. The first bullet struck him in the heart and the second one in the shoulder. And Alberta also provided a gripping bit of testimony. She later recalled the incident by saying, I was standing about 8 feet away from Marvin when my husband came to the door of the bedroom with his pistol. He didn't say anything. He just pointed a gun at Marvin. I screamed, but it was quick. He shot. Marvin screamed. I tried to run. Marvin slid to the floor after the first shot. Well, after that first shot, Marvin Gaye was already dead. The second was nothing more than malice and overkill on the part of his enraged father. Well, Marvin was taken to the hospital, but was declared dead upon arrival. Had he lived, to see just one more day, he would have been 45 years old. At the outset of Marvin Gaye's death, investigators quite easily concluded that Marvin had, in fact, been killed by his own father. And Marvin Gaye Sr. himself admitted that. Sadly, muttering at the time at the crime scene about how he didn't mean to do it. He kept saying he didn't mean to do it, but investigators could safely conclude he most certainly did do it. With such a clear case of guilt, there was really no need to pursue any other angles of investigation in the case. Investigation had essentially come to a close as soon as Marvin Gaye Sr. was in custody. Now, did he really do it, or was he taking the blame for someone else, perhaps his wife? The only suspect in the death of Marvin Gaye has always been his own father. The only real question in this case was whether or not the crime was one that occurred in the heat of an argument, or if there was a more calculated motive for the killing. Now, both Alberta and Marvin Gaye Sr.'s testimony closely corroborated each other, leaving a little doubt as to who the suspect was. Crime scene evidence also clearly pointed to Marvin Gaye Sr. as the prime suspect. Well, Marvin Gaye Sr. was initially charged with a first-degree murder for the killing. It's later reduced to voluntary manslaughter. And Marvin Gaye Sr. pled no contest to voluntary manslaughter on the 20th day of September 1984. He was sentenced only a couple of months later, November 2nd. In the end, he was merely given a 6-year suspended sentence with an additional 5 years of probation. He never served one single day in jail for killing his son. Judge, no doubt, must have taken into consideration the fact that Marvin Gaye Sr. had a clean record and the obvious nature of the crime. Now, it was horrible what the man did to his own son, but by all accounts, it was a crime of passion. The old man had been beaten pretty badly, and in a ballistic state of rage, he pulled the trigger. Without thinking of all the pain and death he'd caused superstar singer Marvin Gaye and lifelong sorrow for himself. Marvin Gaye Sr. had to spend the rest of his life reflecting on the horror of what he had done. And this alone, many said, must have been ample punishment for the man. As for Marvin Sr. himself, on the day of his sentencing, he said, if I could bring him back, I would. I was afraid of him. I thought I was going to get hurt. I don't know what was going to happen. I'm really sorry for everything that did happen. I loved him. I wish he had stepped through the door right now. I'm paying the price. Marvin Gaye Sr. ended up his days in a nursing home. He passed away in 1998. Not a single day in jail for killing his own son. Well, let's talk about the death of Dorothy Stratton. Hollywood, November 1981. There was a suspect, but there was no conviction. Dorothy Stratton was born 20th of February 1960. Born and raised in Vancouver, Canada. She was still a teenager scooping ice cream part-time at a Dairy Queen when she came into contact with a wannabe agent to the stars. Name was Paul Snyder. Snyder began a relationship with the young woman and actually convinced her to have some naked photos taken, which she subsequently sent off to Playboy in 1978. Dorothy was just 19 years old when Playboy came calling, leading to a long-term contract to work for him. This led to Dorothy and Snyder moving to L.A. And as Dorothy continued to work for the magazine and seek further advancement of her career, the two got married in 1979. Dorothy managed to get some roles on TV shortly after that, appearing on TV programs like Fantasy Island and Buck Rogers. This led, in turn, to some parts in movies such as Americathon and the infamous Skate Down USA. Well, in spite of her career taking off, the relationship between Dorothy Stratton and Paul Snyder began to deteriorate. And it's said that Stratton started a relationship with director Peter Bogdanovich. Bogdanovich was the one that directed Dorothy Stratton's last film. They all laughed. Well, this was a comedy piece in which Dorothy Stratton starred alongside John Ritter in the role of an unhappy housewife who falls in love with the character played by Ritter. It was while Stratton was working on the film that Snyder began to realize she was actually having an affair with Bogdanovich, and he went so far as to hire a private detective to have her followed. Fact that stands out as rather ironic, since part of the plot of They All Laughed involves detectives tracking the love affairs of the film's leading ladies. After Stratton got wind of what was happening, she informed Snyder of her plans to leave and moved in with Bogdanovich. She made it clear she was going to file for divorce. Shortly after her intention was made known, Dorothy Stratton lost her life. Frustrated and enraged that his wife was slipping from his grasp, Snyder decided to take matters into his own hand. He went down to L.A. himself, began to quietly stalk Dorothy's every move. Eventually made his way right to Bogdanovich's residence where Stratton was staying. Then he drove around L.A. for a while before he made the fateful decision to kill Dorothy. August 13, 1980, he purchased a shotgun, and the following day on the 14th, he arranged to have Stratton meet with him at the residence he was staying at West Los Angeles. Snyder had two roommates at the time, but they decided to leave that morning so the two former spouses could discuss the terms of their pending divorce. Well, the roommates came back later to find the couple closed up in Paul Snyder's bedroom. Not sure what they might be up to, the roommates turned on a loud television in order to keep to themselves, not interfere. It was actually Snyder's private detective that grew concerned and called up the roommates and urged them to go into the bedroom and check on the strange couple. They went at about 11 p.m. of that when they found the corpses of both Paul Snyder and Dorothy Stratton, each killed with a shotgun wound. Well, the death of Dorothy Stratton was a shock to a lot of folks, but perhaps none felt it more keenly than Playboy founder Hugh Hefner. Stratton had just been picked up as a rising star for Playboy and as her first Playmate of the Year for the first decade of 1980. She'd been touted as the goddess of the new decade. Now, Hugh Hefner himself was said to be pretty shooken up by the incident, but his cold, calculated response to the news didn't let on as much. At the time, he issued a statement that simply read, "The death of Dorothy Stratton comes as a shock to us all." As Playboy's Playmate of the Year, with a film and a television career of increasing importance, her professional future was a bright one. But equally sad to us is the fact that her loss takes from us all a very special member of the Playboy family. Now, this response did hit all the typical sad notes, and since it neglected to mention the horrific nature of her death, one might think she simply died in her sleep. Nevertheless, the investigation into the deaths almost immediately settled on the notion of a murder-suicide perpetuated by the disgruntled Paul Snyder. The two had both died from a gunshot wound from Snyder's shotgun, making this seem to be a clear enough possibility. Well, the additional speculation was generated from the fact that both of them were nude when they were killed. So the question is, had the couple engaged in intimacy just prior to the murder-suicide taking place? Although the details weren't fully known, it's been suggested by investigators maybe Dorothy Stratton was sexually assaulted by Snyder before he shot her. Then he shot himself. Detail that almost escapes most reports is the fact that Stratton had a finger missing. It's believed that after Stratton was dead, Snyder, for reasons unknown to himself, engaged in a slight dismemberment of her corpse. Autopsy results seem to suggest that Snyder perished about a half hour after Stratton died. And this gave Paul Snyder several minutes to inflict additional post-mortem torment on Dorothy. Well, the main suspect has always been Dorothy Stratton's estranged husband, Paul Snyder. But the main suspect deceased. There was no trial or conviction. Stratton is buried at the Westwood Memorial Park Cemetery in Los Angeles. Studios refused to release her last movie. They all laughed, considering the gruesome murder of Stratton. The movie was released in 1988 by Bogdanovich personally, but it was a total flop and almost ruined him financially. Snyder's family got their hands on Stratton's estate after suing for it. Snyder and Stratton were still married, making Snyder only beneficiary. But it does leave the question, could someone else have killed them both? We only have the roommate's word for the fact that they didn't go in. Well, then we have the murder of Selena Quintanilla Perez in San Antonio. Took place in March 1995. Suspect was Yolanda Saldivar. Now, Selena was a superstar. Born in the town of Lake Jackson in the state of Texas, April 16, 1971. Daughter of a music producer and business entrepreneur by the name of Abraham Quintanilla and his wife, Marcella. Father realized Selena had a musical talent early on in her life and encouraged her to hone her musical skills. Her father was her first manager and put her in her first music group, Selena and Los Dinos. Selena seemed to be a rising star, but her grades in school began to suffer. Her father ended up letting her drop out completely after the eighth grade so she could finish school through a home-based correspondence course, which she completed successfully at the age of 17. Her first big break came in 1989 when she was signed for EMI Latin Records. It was with this record company Selena produced the self-titled record Selena. Now, the album wasn't exactly a smash hit, but she did see some traction on the music charts. The album followed in the 1990s, Vencomingo, with gained a wide following in Mexico. It's about this time that Selena got the attention of a woman named Yolanda Saldivar. Now, Ms. Saldivar actually contacted her father and proposed the idea of starting a fan club for Selena based out of San Antonio, Texas. She said it was in order to get the word out about Selena's music. You know, Mr. Quintanilla, thinking it was a reasonable idea, gave her the green light to do so. Thanks to her efforts, Yolanda not only increased Selena's recognition, but also became quite close to Selena herself. Someone else who became close to Selena at that time was a band member by the name of Chris Perez. Now, Selena's father wasn't happy when he got word of the romance, fearing it would derail Selena's career, and he told the couple to stop seeing each other. And Perez, who was a gifted bass guitarist in his own right, ended up leaving the band. But he continued to see Selena behind the scenes, culminating in the couple secretly eloping to get married. They got married in secret on the 2nd of April in 1992. Now, Mr. Quintanilla was upset, but eventually came around to the idea and not only accepted the marriage, but brought Chris Perez back into the band. On the heels of all these developments, Selena cut her next record, Entre a Mi Mundo, which was a smashing success, reaching number one on the U.S. Billboard Regional Mexican Albums chart. 1993, she then followed up this success with a live album, simply named Live.
Album won a Grammy for Best Mexican-American Album. About this time, Yolanda Saldivar, the former director of Selena's fan club, had weaseled her way into becoming Selena's manager. Soon, though, Yolanda's world began to unravel. When in January of 1995, Selena's father, Quintanilla, would get tipped off that Yolanda was ripping off fans who'd paid membership fees and pocketing the money for herself.
Okay, Mr. Quintanilla looked up Yolanda and said if she didn't come up with an explanation for what was happening, he was going to go to the police. Told Selena in the meantime to stay away from Yolanda. Selena, though, found it kind of hard to part company with Yolanda, who otherwise seemed totally devoted to her career. So March 31st, 1995, Selena met up with Yolanda at a hotel in an attempt to resolve some of the issues once and for all. March 31st, Selena was found shot to death in a motel. Previous night, she and her husband had arrived at the motel together, but there was a third party involved. Yolanda. A middle-aged, domineering woman she'd called the shots for Selena for some time was... She was meeting with her at the hotel, supposedly to hammer out some of the pending details in her latest contract. At some point, though, in a discussion, Yolanda pulled out a gun and shot Selena right in the middle of her back. With ruptured arteries spilling blood, Selena was mortally wounded, but she still struggled. The last of her energy managed to run out of the motel room, down the hall, and fell in a heap and on the floor of the hotel lobby. Well, just before she died, she named Yolanda as her killer. With any further doubt, shortly after that, Yolanda herself came charging into the lobby, waving a gun and calling the dying Selena a bitch. Shortly after Selena's death, the main suspect, Yolanda, fled the scene in a pickup truck, but was tracked down by the police shortly after that. She feigned suicidal ideation, put the gun to her head while the police and the FBI negotiated with her for several hours. At various points during this ordeal, she seemed on the verge of complying with officers, but as soon as one approached the car, she put the gun to her head and even put it in her mouth, indicating that the police came any closer, she'd shoot. Finally, though, she was convinced to put the gun down and ceased taking herself hostage. She was taken into police custody. No further major incident, but Yolanda was so emotionally panicked, sobbing and crying, police put a coat over her to shield her from onlookers. Well, the public, of course, was enraged, and the crowds already swarmed around the area that had been cordoned off by the police. Even after Yolanda was put behind bars, fans began to wait outside the jail, thinking maybe she might make bail. And if she did, they planned on finishing the job once and for all. Just prior to being put on trial, though, authorities put Yolanda under protective custody to safeguard herself and from others who might want to do her harm. Due to the sensational nature of the crime and the outpouring of grief for the victim, the sheriff was quoted as saying, "We don't want to take any chances because there are people who want to retaliate." Well, she's put on trial for Selena's death in October 1995. Just a few days after the trial had started, the jury rather quickly deliberated, and Yolanda was found guilty as charged and given a sentence of life in prison. She has a chance of parole in 2025, but wouldn't hold my breath. Well, let's talk about the murder of Lana Clarkson. Took place in Hollywood, 2003. Suspect was Phil Spector. Now, Lana Clarkson was born in 1962 and grew up in Sonoma County, California. After high school, she moved to Southern California and into L.A., where she began to work as a model and sought gigs as an actress. All right, she got a break when she landed a small part for Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Then she got a part in the 1983 gangster film Scarface. And shortly after that, she was recruited by filmmaker Roger Corman for his epic sword and sorcery movie, Deathstalker. In this piece, she starred as a romantic lead opposite the main character. And this led to another. The infamous 1985 flick Barbarian Queen, in which Lana Clarkson played none other than the Barbarian Queen. Many regard these features as B-movies, so it's with some irony that a couple of years after this, in 1987, she took part in a science fiction satire entitled Amazon Women on the Moon. Yeah.
Well, after that, she replies to Barbarian Queen Roll to appear in Barbarian Queen 2, The Empress Strikes Back. Then in 1990, she made the film Haunting of Morella, the film with a horror supernatural plot that had Lana delving into the occult to contact the soul of a sorceress who was killed during the Salem Witch Trials. And although her films are largely written off by critics as being a bit cheesy in the realm of B-movies, she had cultivated a large fan base and often invited to Comic-Cons to reprise her Barbarian Warrior roles. Throughout the 1990s, she made several more television and film appearances. By the early 2000s, though, her career had slowed down considerably. Tempted to market some of her memorabilia in various works on a website, which didn't bring in enough money, she actually resorted to getting a part-time job as a waitress at the House of Blues in West Hollywood, California. Now, this was something of a come-down from a woman who'd previously enjoyed the life of an actress on demand. Seeing the bright lights of Hollywood, only to have them rapidly dim right in front of her eyes. And it was while she was struggling to get her footing back that her life would come to a sudden end. January 3rd, 2003. Actress Lana Clarkson's dead body was discovered at the residence of legendary studio genius Phil Spector. Well known for his work with the Beatles and other famous musicians during his heyday in the 60s and 70s. And he was a frequent patron at the House of Blues and got to know Lana Clarkson after she started working there. So on that February day, she left her job at the restaurant in the company of Phil Spector to further hang out with him at his residence. And they were driven by Spector's personal chauffeur, who also remained outside, seated in the vehicle while Spector and Lana went inside. Some time had passed before the chauffeur heard what sounded like a gun going off somewhere inside the house. He spotted Phil Spector running out of the house with a gun in his hand, and Spector, apparently not trying to hide anything, said something along the lines of, "I think I just shot her." Well, investigators didn't have to look far for Lana Clarkson's killer, and according to Phil Spector's chauffeur, he had admitted to the crime. But upon being taken into custody, he changed his story. He told police he believed that she had succumbed to an accidental suicide. Spector tried to say that Lana Clarkson was playing around with his gun and tried to kiss it. According to Phil, that's when the gun went off. Police, of course, weren't ready to believe this version, though, and soon Phil was being brought up on charges for Lana's murder. And he was really the only suspect believed to have been involved in Lana Clarkson's murder, unless you count the chauffeur. Phil Spector was first put on trial in fall of 2007, but this trial was overturned after it resulted in a hung jury. New trials convened on October 20th, 2008, and after a long, dramatic ordeal, Spector was found guilty as charged April 13, 2009. Got a 19-year-to-life sentence. Ultimately finished out his term by way of his own death when he died from COVID-19 in 2021. Well, a lot of strange happenings going on. Then we've got the death of Bonnie Lee Beckley, Hollywood, May 2001. Robert Blake was the main suspect. Now, Bonnie Lee Beckley was born in Morristown, New Jersey, June 7, 1956, and moved to New York to pursue acting. Didn't work out, though. By early 20s, she'd married and been divorced two times, had a number of kids in between. Strapped for cash during the 80s, she resorted to regularly peddling smut and scamming gullible men to make a living. Began posting want ads in the Lonely Hearts section of local newspapers. Any man desperate enough to respond would inevitably get scammed out of some money by Bonnie. In these pre-internet days, she was also known to send erotic pictures of herself and others to her clients in the mail. Now, her less than respectable enterprises and involvement with a series of sketchy characters eventually got her in trouble. In 1989, for example, she was put in jail for drug possession. 1995, she was hit up with charges of check fraud. For a check fraud incident, she was fined $1,000 and actually made to labor in a penal farm for restitution. Along with Bonnie's attempts to scam lonely, obscure men, she also wanted to reel in one of the stars, and she confided in those who knew her. She desired to get into a relationship with a Hollywood celebrity. Well, somebody rich and famous, of course, would be able to open up doors for her that the average Joe just couldn't or wouldn't be able to. Was this in mind, she first ran into Robert Blake at a jazz club in 1999. Shortening their relationship, Bonnie discovered she was pregnant. Using this baby as her ticket to get hitched to a star, Bonnie suggested they get married. Well, Robert Blake agreed, but made her sign a prenuptial agreement. And the agreement was more than a little odd. It stipulated Bonnie had to have written permission for anyone to visit Robert Blake's ranch house, and if one of them was to initiate a divorce, custody of the baby would automatically go to the other one. Now, the couple got married in November 2000. Low-budget affair. Robert Blake apparently didn't even dress up for it. Seen wearing his casual everyday clothes, Bonnie had on a full-blown wedding gown. Only a few people attended the event, but Blake was sure to have at least one person on hand, his personal attorney. After getting married, although Bonnie and the baby moved onto the property, they stayed in the bungalow guest house rather than under the same roof as Robert Blake. Robert Blake, rather than having a wife, seemed to have simply brought an estranged dependent onto his property. Shortly into this arrangement, Blake apparently began to seriously wonder what this woman was doing in her free time. Actually hired a private detective to look into her background, and he discovered Bonnie Lee Backley was still actively scamming other men out of money, even after she married Robert Blake. It wasn't long after this revelation that Bonnie's life came to an end. Bonnie Lee Backley had dinner with her husband, Robert Blake, May 4, 2001, dining at an upmarket Italian bistro called Vitello's. Blake was a regular at this joint, so regular in fact, ended up naming a menu item after him. Consisting of spinach, tomato, and pasta, his favorite meal was dubbed Fusilli a la Robert Blake. And Blake was seated in the back of the restaurant that night. After ordering their usual fare, the couple dined to the tunes of a nearby piano player. Sometime in between eating and leaving, Blake was seen going to the restroom. Patron later clearly recalls seeing the actor vomiting into a trash can and pulling at his hair and mumbling to himself. Now, this seemed to most folks to be an obvious sign of distress. After leaving the restroom, he continued to appear sickly. But he hadn't drunk any alcohol, and his food didn't seem to be amiss. Whatever was bothering him, he kept to himself. After paying for the meal, the couple left, leaving patrons to wonder what was wrong with that megastar. After he and Bonnie got back to the car, Blake realized he'd forgotten something. It wasn't his keys or his wallet. Left his gun behind. Not the typical item a patron simply forgets. But this was apparently the case. Realizing his gun had been left behind, Blake told his wife Bonnie to hang tight while he went back to get it. According to Robert Blake's version of events, it was after he returned to the car he found Bonnie deceased with a bullet in her brain, slumped over and bleeding profusely. And according to Blake, he had no idea who just killed his wife. Apparently some random psychopath just ran up on Bonnie and pulled the trigger. Or maybe it was an old enemy come out of the woodwork. His account seemed a little hard to believe, but stranger things have happened. At any rate, Blake's response was a little unusual, to say the least. Instead of immediately calling the police or calling 911, he took off on foot to the nearby residence of a friend of his, Hollywood director Sean Stanek. Now, although through Stanek, the authorities would be called to the scene, the whole world subsequently heard the news of this strange and horrific event. Strangely enough, Blake was missing for the rest of this affair. Already clear Bonnie had passed, but nevertheless, most husbands would have been present with their wife's body as it was transported from the scene, but not Blake. He got media attention, though, when he put himself in the hospital. According to his attorney, Blake was in an absolute state of shock. An exaggerated version of events, since a real culprit was his high blood pressure. But that's not to say Blake wasn't rattled by the event. He most certainly was. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. This is Friday, so we'll be back on Monday and finish talking about the investigation into the murder of Robert Blake's wife. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.